Good morning. This is Wendy Bauer reading to you today, March 1st, 2021, from the Decatur Herald and Review. And we'll begin on the front page with the article headlined, "Hundreds Gather to Mourn Slain Officer. Lieutenant Lasco Will Be Buried in Decatur." Hundreds gathered on a gloomy Sunday to honor the life of Eugene Lasco, a longtime lieutenant with Indiana Department of Corrections who was born in Decatur. Lasco, 57, died February 21st after being stabbed at Indiana State Prison, where he worked for nearly 12 years. On Sunday, Lasco received his final call. Unit 15, ISP Control. Unit 15, ISP Control. Unit 15, Lieutenant Eugene Lasco Sr., ISP Control, a solemn voice announced over a radio. On February 21st, 2021, Indiana Department of Correction Lieutenant Eugene Lee Lasco Sr. answered his final call. The voice continued, breaking in the middle of the message. While assisting another officer who was being attacked, Lieutenant Lasco was fatally stabbed. There is no greater love than a man than would lay down his life for another. Indiana Department of Correction Lieutenant Eugene Lee Lasco Sr., Unit 15, is 1042. He has gone home for the final time. Friends, family, and law enforcement officers gathered indoors and outdoors once the Auric Shrine Hall reached capacity Sunday at the Michigan City Hall to say goodbye to Lasco. An American flag was draped over his casket as it came out of the hall, where Lasco was honored by the dozens, including Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, who attended his funeral. On Monday, a police escort will accompany him to Graceland Cemetery in Decatur for burial. According to previous reporting by the Times of Northwest Indiana, Lasco and Sergeant Patrick Schmidt were in a common area about 2:30 p.m. February 21st when inmate Timitri Campbell, 38, attacked Schmidt and stabbed him multiple times, IDOC said. Lasco went to help Schmidt, and Campbell stabbed Lasco. Both Lasco and Schmidt were taken to Franciscan Health Hospital in Michigan City, where Lasco was pronounced dead. His death was ruled a homicide, LaPorte County Coroner Lynn Swanson said. Campbell was being held on preliminary charges, including murder, Indiana State Police have said. No formal charges have been filed as of Sunday, online records showed. After a private funeral service, traditional graveside services were performed at Auric Shrine. A riderless horse, Wyatt, accompanied by Captain Dale Thomas of the LaPorte County Sheriff's Office, rode by Lasco's casket, signifying the fallen officer looking back on his troops, Thomas said. Indiana Metropolitan Police Department Captain Don Weilhammer explained the services, including the folding of the flag, a 21-gun salute, and taps and bagpipes being played, were held on Sunday as Lasco is being buried in Decatur, Illinois, on Monday. Logistically, it would be next to impossible for us all to go into Illinois, he said. Come Monday, Lasco will be escorted to the Indiana-Illinois state line, where Illinois State Police will take him to his final resting place, Weilhammer said. Various members of law enforcement, including from IDOC, the Michigan City Police Department, and Indiana State Police, were present Sunday, as well as correction officers from across the U.S. John Bray, a lieutenant with the Rhode Island Department of Corrections, traveled to Michigan City on Sunday to pay his respects. It means a lot to us to come out and show the family that they're not by themselves. We are truly a brotherhood, said Bray, who also is a commander with the Rhode Island Brotherhood of Correction Officers. People forget about us. They often refer to us as the forgotten law enforcement because when the inmates are prosecuted and locked up, they are forgotten about by most people in society. And then we're the law enforcement, the firefighters, and the EMTs that have to deal with these people. Unfortunately, society seems to forget that we're there also. Bray, who has been an officer for 25 years, said it was good to see such a turnout on Sunday, but unfortunately, it never seems like there's enough. There's a very heavy turnout with the law enforcement and from other departments around the country, and it makes us feel good, he added. And continuing on the front page, Miller addresses militia decal. Democratic county leaders in Illinois want an investigation of Republican State Representative Chris Miller after he displayed a decal of an anti-government militia movement on his pickup truck parked at the U.S. Capitol during the deadly insurrection in January. The Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association asked for a state investigation after photos of Miller's truck with a sticker for the Three Percenters surfaced on social media. Miller denied involvement with the group. He was in Washington, D.C. for former President Donald Trump's speech on January 6th, and where his wife, new U.S. Representative Mary Miller, delivered a speech in quoting Adolf Hitler that drew wide outrage. Officials ranging from Governor J.B. Pritzker to Eastern Illinois University President David Glassman condemned the statements. In a social media post from the Trump speech site, Chris Miller contended the nation was engaged in a great cultural war between free market capitalism, or whether they will put us in the tyranny of socialism, communism, and the dangerous Democrat terrorists that are trying to destroy our country. The Anti-Defamation League has identified Three Percenters as part of the militia movement, most recently opposing pandemic restrictions and contending protests of police brutality against black people was part of a Democratic conspiracy as part of efforts to take down the Trump administration. Miller did not respond to a request to speak by phone. Instead, he issued a statement in which he said the decal was given to his son by a family friend who said it represented patriotism and love of country. He said he was never part of the Three Percenters movement and didn't know what it was. I have since removed the sticker. My intention was to display what I thought was a patriotic statement, Miller said. I love our country and consider myself a patriot. My intention was not to hurt or offend anyone, but simply to express what I thought was a statement of patriotism. Still, Christina Zahorek, leader of the county chairs, submitted a request to the Office of the Legislative Inspector General on Friday to investigate Miller's actions during the January 6th insurrection. Miller's attendance at the rally that turned into a mob and insurrection of our nation's capital is troubling, and to date, many unanswered questions remain about his subsequent actions and whereabouts that day, Zahorek said. Coles County Republican Party Chairman Travis Coffey couldn't be reached for comment Sunday. Mack White, the County Democratic Party Chairman in Coles County, Miller's home county, said he believes there could only be two reasons for the Miller's actions, and both are condemnable. Either the Millers truly believe the presidential election was stolen, or they're faking to get voters as part of a cynical ploy for the base of the Republican Party, he said. Those are the two options we have, White said. Both are terrible. White also said he doesn't believe either Chris or Mary Miller represent the entirety of their districts. Republican U.S. Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who is among 10 GOP House members to vote to impeach Trump, said he supported looking further at the matter. Representative Miller put a militia sticker on his car and is suspected to have been at the insurrection, Kinziger wrote on Twitter. Our party needs to handle this, and I support further investigation. The Millers own Miller Brother Farms, where they raise corn, soybeans, and cattle. He also founded the Father-Son Camp, an annual camping event. The 110th District stretches from west of Mattoon and Charleston to the Indiana border and south to Lawrenceville. And continuing on the front page, Biden readies infrastructure package. Looking beyond the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, President Joe Biden and lawmakers are laying the groundwork for another top legislative priority, a long-sought boost to the nation's roads, bridges, and other infrastructure that could run into Republican resistance to a hefty price tag. Biden and his team have begun discussions on the possible outlines of an infrastructure package with members of Congress, particularly mindful that Texas's recent struggles with power outages and water shortages after a brutal winter storm present an opportunity for agreement on sustained spending on infrastructure. Republicans say if the White House approach on the COVID relief bill, which passed the House Saturday on a near party line vote and now heads to the Senate, is a sign of things to come for Biden's plan on infrastructure and other initiatives, it could be a difficult road ahead in Congress. A White House proposal could come out later this month. Now is the time to be aggressive, said Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, a former South Bend, Indiana mayor who knows potholes. At a conference with state and local highway officials, he referred to the often promised, never achieved mega initiative on roads, bridges, and the like from the Trump administration. I know you are among those who are working and waiting most patiently, or maybe impatiently, for the moment when Infrastructure Week will no longer be a kind of Groundhog's Day promise, but actually be something that delivers generational investments, he said. Much of America's infrastructure, roads, bridges, public drinking and water systems, dams, airports, mass transit, and more, is in need of major restoration after years of underfunding, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. In its 2017 Infrastructure Report Card, it gave the national infrastructure an overall grade of D+. Both chambers of Congress will use as starting points their unsuccessful efforts to get infrastructure bills through the last session. Democrats passed a $1.5 trillion package in the House last year, but it went nowhere with the Trump administration and the Republican-led Senate. A Senate panel approved narrower bipartisan legislation in 2019, focused on reauthorizing federal transportation programs. It, too, flamed out as the U.S. turned its focus to elections and COVID-19. Biden has talked bigger numbers, and some Democrats are now urging him to bypass Republicans in the closely divided Congress to address a broader range of priorities urged by interest groups. During the presidential campaign, Biden pledged to deploy $2 trillion on infrastructure and clean energy. But the White House has not ruled out an even higher price tag. Pointing to the storm in Texas as a wake-up call for the need to improve energy systems and other infrastructure, Gina McCarthy, Biden's national climate advisor, told the Associated Press that Biden's plan will specifically aim at green and other initiatives that promote job creation. She cited, as an example, federal investments to boost workers that have been left behind by closed coal mines or power plants, as well as communities located near polluting refineries and other hazards. He's been a long fan of investing in infrastructure, long outdated, long overdue, I should say, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Thursday. But he also wants to do more on caregiving, help our manufacturing sector, do more to strengthen access to affordable health care. So the size of the package, the components of it, the order that he has not yet been determined. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, recently told the White House that he's ready to use the budget maneuver known as reconciliation to pass a broad economic recovery package with only Democratic votes. That drew stern warnings from Republicans who have already closed ranks against Democrats' COVID-19 relief bill. And moving to the local and nation page, explore with Lenore, cycling on snow, fat bikes with extra wide tires, so much fun to ride. Tom Keller pedaled his fat bike into a ditch filled with drifted snow, tipped over, and laughed like a kid. You're less likely to get hurt when you're falling in big, fluffy snow, he said. Just moments before, Keller had mentioned how a fat bike, a bicycle with extra wide tires, designed for riding in snow, brings out the child in you. I like to describe fat bikes like when you were a kid and got your first big wheel, said Keller. The Bloomington man races mountain bikes for the Bloomington Cycle and Fitness Racing Team, but he rides fat bikes just for fun. It's just so forgiving, and I think that's part of the fun about it, said Keller. You can hit a curb, and the impact is so much less to you that all of a sudden you start to see things and you kind of regress back to being a kid. Double dog dare me, I bet you I can ride this. Scott Davis, co-owner of Bloomington Cycle and Fitness, got his first fat bike about 10 years ago. He said sales have been declining in recent years because there's only enough snow to use them for a short period of time. However, with the pandemic increasing interest in outdoor exercise, including cycling, sales of all bikes have boomed. Davis said he has no fat bikes to sell at this moment. They can be ridden any time of year, but they are more work to ride than other types of bikes. That's due in part to the extremely low pressure in the tires. Where a mountain bike might have tire pressurized to 20 psi and hybrid or road bikes considerably higher than that, tires on a fat bike might only be inflated to 6 psi. It provides stability and comfort, said Davis, who warned, if the pressure isn't right, they are hard to handle. Reagan Rinchuso of Normal loves her fat bike, but said, I'm about as tired doing 10 miles on my fat bike as I am doing 20 to 30 miles on my road bike. I love riding a fat bike because you can take it almost anywhere. It easily goes off-road, she said. I can ride it over snow, too, so that has allowed me to ride pretty much all winter, which I never did before I got a fat bike. Although fat bikes are thought of as winter bikes or snow bikes, some people ride them in the sand along beaches, a big reason for their popularity in snowy Marquette, Michigan, which has miles of shoreline along Lake Superior. The fickle nature of snow in central Illinois has been evident this winter. A week ago, there was almost too much snow to ride even a fat bike on trails in this area without getting bogged down. Less than a week later, melting snow made trails too muddy to ride without damaging them. But if you travel farther north to Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you will find more consistent snow and even groomed trails, where the snow is packed down for easier riding, even where the snow is measured in feet. Heed the signs that say, don't ride muddy trails, and be sure bikes are permitted where you want to ride. Several trails in Kamlara Park in McLean County, including the Shady Hollow Nature Trail and Mallard Cove Access Trail, are listed as foot traffic only on the park's website. Rinchuso said her advice to anyone considering a fat bike is don't take one for a test ride unless you're ready to buy. It's so much fun to ride that you'll be sold from the first time you get on it. And next, COVID-19 infection immunity similar to vaccine. One of the enduring questions of the COVID-19 pandemic is how much immunity people are left with after recovering from a coronavirus infection. New research suggests the level of protection is comparable to getting a vaccine, at least for a few months. Among a group of hundreds of thousands of Americans who tested positive for a SARS-CoV-2 infection, the risk of developing a subsequent infection more than 3 months later was about 90% lower than for people who had not been previously infected and therefore had no immunity to the virus, according to researchers from the National Cancer Institute. For the sake of comparison, when the vaccines made by Pfizer and BioNTech and Moderna were tested in Phase 3 clinical trials, they reduced the risk of developing COVID-19 by at least 94%. The findings, published in JAMA Internal Medicine, could help inform plans for returning workers to their offices, sending students and teachers back to school campuses, and allowing more of the economy to reopen. I think we knew this, that immunity after natural infection lasts a long time, said Dr. Monica Gandhi, an infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco who was not involved in the new research. But it's still very exciting. There are three important things scientists need to know to understand the biological value of coronavirus antibodies, said Dr. Mitchell H. Katz, who leads NYC Health and Hospitals. They are, do antibodies protect against infection? Can they be reliably detected with current tests? And if they do offer some protection, how long does it last? The new study provides reassuring answers to the first and second questions, Katz wrote in an editor's note that accompanied the study. To investigate coronavirus immunity, the cancer researchers examined the results of more than 3 million blood tests administered to Americans between the start of the pandemic and August 23rd. A total of 378,606 of those tests were positive for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies, a sign that the person who provided the sample had an active coronavirus infection. Among the millions of people who were tested, some, about 11% of those who tested positive and 9.5% of those who tested negative, later took a different test to look for evidence of the coronavirus's genetic material in patient samples, which are typically gathered via the nose, throat, or from saliva. The researchers used these results to see whether people who'd had a coronavirus infection were any less likely than their uninfected counterparts to have SARS-CoV-2 particles in their system. For their analysis, they sorted the results into four groups based on the gap between the antibody test and the genetic test. After running the numbers, the researchers found that between 3% and 4% of those who originally tested negative for coronavirus antibodies later tested positive with the genetic test. This was true across all four time intervals, 0 to 30 days, 31 to 60 days, 61 to 90 days, and more than 90 days. The consistency was probably a reflection of the relatively stable rate at which people in their communities were being infected at the time, the researchers said. Contrast that to the people who originally tested positive for coronavirus antibodies. Their genetic test results were positive at very high rates in the first 30 days, 11.3%, which the researchers said was probably a sign that leftover viral particles were still being flushed from their systems. However, the positivity rate for the genetic test plunged to 2.7% in the second month after infection, then fell to 1.1% in the third month. And after those 90 days, only 0.3% of people with a past coronavirus infection had another infection that was detected with a genetic test. That coronavirus infection rate was 10 times lower than for the people who presumably had not been previously infected. That level of protection appears to be comparable to the benefits offered by the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines in their clinical trials, the study authors pointed out. Of course, protection induced by a safe vaccine is clearly preferable, they were quick to add, as the population-wide risk of a serious outcome from an authorized or approved vaccine is expected to be orders of magnitude lower than that from natural infection. Though the findings may be of great interest to scientists, it's unlikely they'll make much practical difference at this stage of the pandemic, Gandhi said. That's because vaccines appear to be at least as protective as a past infection, and they're already being rolled out. These findings could have been used 2 months ago, she added. While this study didn't gauge how long the benefits of a prior infection last beyond 90 days, other lines of evidence suggest it takes a while to wane. For instance, Gandhi pointed to a paper in Science that found that immune cells triggered by SARS-CoV-2 remained in the body for at least 8 months. The findings may help explain why new infections have been falling in Los Angeles County in the wake of a devastating holiday surge. Dr. Roger Lewis, director of COVID-19 hospital demand modeling for the LA County Department of Health Services, estimated that about 1 out of 3 people in the county now has immunity to the coronavirus. And next, study says gyms can readily spread virus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is urging stricter precautions for gym-goers after tracing coronavirus outbreaks to fitness centers in Hawaii and Chicago that left dozens of patrons with COVID-19. The findings, detailed in 2 papers published recently in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, highlights the risks of indoor fitness activities, particularly when guidelines about mask wearing and social distancing are not enforced. But even when worn properly, face masks may not do enough to mitigate the risk of indoor group classes, said Dr. Larry William Chang, an infectious disease specialist at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, who is not involved in the research. I personally would never join a group class in an enclosed space with poor ventilation, Chang said. I think that's just a recipe for disaster. The first of the 2 outbreak cases took place in Hawaii and began in late June after 2 fitness instructors, one apparently infected by the other, transmitted the virus to patrons before developing any symptoms of COVID-19. A total of 21 people who were exposed to either of the instructors in the 24-hour period before they showed signs of illness wound up becoming infected after attending a class or personal training session. Another 8 patrons were exposed in the 24-hour period before that, and one of them contracted the coronavirus as well. And this ends our first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for March 1st, 2021. We'll take a short break now. Please stay tuned for the second half hour.